Accession number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, reel 23. Now, anything else about your time with the squadron?
Well, I think really just to say, you know, what a fulfilling time it was. And it was a marvellous mix of different exercises that were already there in the syllabus, and also these extra stretching ones, which we're able to do. And I think it was a very happy squadron, and remarkably, considering the experience level, how well they coped, the youngsters, and how they enjoyed, because there were only, I think then, by then there were only five, might have been six, hunter squadrons around the world on the, and yet they all were so pleased when they made operational status on the squadrons. And it was a really fine, demanding role that we had, because these redeployments, I think I mentioned that the equipment, navigation equipment on the Hunter, apart from the DME, was not that good. This ADF that was supposed to, automatic direction finding, the NDB, really, that equipment was not that good, really. It was a bit Mickey Mouse. And it was quite demanding sometimes, because you think that flying down in the Mediterranean was always easy, but you had to take into account that sometimes the weather down there wasn't so good, because amazingly, the weather could be quite bad down in Gibraltar. And it was just really, we felt on the Hunter side, even then, probably for 3 or 4 years, we'd thought that the Hunter 9, the development there, should have had a sidewinder capability. And it took the Falklands and that to bring this forward, which was considerably later for the Harrier side.
Now, what do you mean about sidewinder?
Well, what we felt was that in many ways, and it's understandable looking back in history, that the V-Force did have all the budget, and they did seem to have an excessive budget to us, and even though the Hunter 9 was well developed in many ways in terms of the weapons it had, it probably could have even been better if it had that sidewinder facility as well.
Why? For what is a sidewinder? I
mean, well, it was really the missile for an air-to-air missile capability that was there that I think we could have had if the Hunter hadn't been looked upon as being the end of a, you know, the, because it wasn't really at the end of its days, and it was redeveloped with other air forces way beyond then, and it was a very popular, and some of the Hunters went through 3 or 4 air forces before they completed their lives, because they were strong and sturdy and extremely versatile. I haven't mentioned the Torrey Canyon, I don't think, have I?
No.
The Torrey Canyon was, I think it was, the tanker went aground on something like the 18th, it was, the 18th of March in 1967. And almost immediately, I think within 2 days, I think the Navy Buccaneers had bombed it. And the oil, I think there were 118,000 long tons of Q80 oil were spewing out. The Torrey Canyon was a tanker which broke its back effectively, or gradually broke its back, on the Seven Stones Reef, which was out on the Scillies. Now, we came into the picture on the 28th of March, and actually flew down as 1, 2, 3. See, there were just 3 of us. That's right. The boss and Brian Walton and myself were tasked, and the fascinating thing I always remember was that station commander was actually running the ops desk, which was unknown. And Wilson was very involved. As you know, the Prime Minister was down on the Scilly Isles actually watching some of what was going on. But we were tasked to try and miss the Torrey Canyon but it was so big it was probably a bit difficult to miss in a way. But
what?
The interesting aspect was
hit what then? You would have to miss the Torrey Canyon.
To
miss
the Torrey Canyon
by firing
with
the North Atlantic.
The briefing was to just miss it with our napalm. Now, napalm was a highly politically contentious substance. And we were having our 100-gallon tanks filled with napalm on the outboard tanks. And an important part of this little story is that we had explosive release cartridges, and if you look at the Hunter 9s, they've got tiny little on outboard, well out on the wings, a little, I want to say, I think it is fiberglass coverage. It might be metal, but I don't think so, where there's a little kind of nodule on the top which covers the explosive release mechanisms for the outboard tanks. It was really to make certain that they didn't roll in and damage the aircraft, and also when they went clear if you were maneuvering at the same time and wanted to get rid of your outboards. Because it was so contentious and such an important thing to do it when we were tasked to do it, the airmen, splendidly, all the armourers worked right through the night to mix up the correct jelly mix of the napalm and the sorting out the fuses. There were Swedish fuses, which, as it turned out, some of them were out of date. They were actually beyond their sort of use-by date. And I think that affected at least half of our 600 gallons of napalm that were dropped. But because of the worry about the political aspect of napalm, we took off and went straight as a die, so that's no more than 12 miles up to the North Sea, over the sea, and then we went all the way around from the Norfolk coast, round every bit of coast, obviously cutting across here and in there, but never crossing the land. We were always out to sea, all the way round to the Scilly Isles, so it was a long route down there. It was then I think the boss went in to start with, and either his tanks didn't fire and didn't ignite anything. But Brian Walton was number two, and he dropped his, and I think partly perhaps he might have had the best fuses put in by knowing the armourers and getting more involved with it, and his actually set the whole thing on fire, and he was right ahead of me, and I realised I'd have to not attack that time because I'd be wasting it, so I went round for a further attack, and in reflection I probably should have gone instead of a level attack, which we'd been briefed for. It might have been better if I'd had the quick wit to do a dive attack because of the smoke. But the interesting thing then, when I went in on the run at 400 knots at 50 feet, was the amazing way that the brain either speeds up or events slow down. Because I can remember working it out later from the smoke on the actual photographs that were taken at that time, and you could work out that it was 0.6 of a second I was actually in the smoke, but in that 0.6 of a second I had at least four, if not five, clear inputs in my head. The first one was, I'm at 50 foot, I've got to go on instruments. The normal immediate reaction you have if you're in cloud is, I ought to be on instruments. That was the first one. And the second one was, I've got to think about pickling. The third one was, I've got to watch that mast, because pickling. It was a mast. Where to actually drop the, you press the tip to drop the 100-gallon napalm tanks. The second or third thing that was in my head, as I say, was that the mast was there, and then the third iteration was actually to pickle, to press the tip and drop them in the middle of the smoke while I was still effectively on instruments at 50 feet, which isn't a normal thing to be. And then I'd never operated the explosive release mechanism before, and there was this bloody great explosive jolt on both sides. And of course, through my head was the fact I'd hit the mast. That was the first thing in my head, was there I was in the smoke, the things had gone, and I must have hit the mast because of the amount of shock and noise and shudder to the wings. And then of course I was out in the sunlight again, and fortunately all in one piece. But it was amazing that one could actually work out from your speed how much was going through your brain at that time. And the boss and the three of us landed at Jivna, and I can remember his dry wit, because he had a very slow northern wit, and it was intriguing to listen to him being interviewed when he landed at Jivna. And then the others from Jivna, I think, were tasked with trying to keep the whole thing burning again. And it was a mixed success, really. But in many ways, the Torrey Canyon later, I think to start with, it was thought to be a terrible thing environmentally, but in actual fact, partly because of the way that they learned more about it, I don't think it was quite as bad, although a lot went down to France and the way it emulsifies and that, because I saw a report much later on it all. But obviously there were major problems with the oil pollution on that coast.
Anything else with the squadron, or any other incidents or special missions?
We used Salisbury Plain quite a lot for exercises.
What kind of exercise? And,
well, normally with the army, and with also there was a PTA up at near Thetford. And really what was splendid was the amount of ranges we used all round the country, up to Scotland, Otterburn and Tain Range, away up in northern Scotland, and the Theddlethorpe Cowden Range, lots on the east coast, and the sheer amount of live weapons that we were allowed to fire as part of our role. Plus, as I've mentioned, this redeployment aspect of it made it a very demanding but very rewarding role. And I haven't mentioned, obviously, we did other things, like down at Gibraltar. Quite apart from the Navy, we would do affiliation with Canberra sometimes down there, and practice interceptions down there. And also, I can remember doing affiliation with helicopters and Andovers, because Andovers and helicopter sounds as a very easy target for a fighter, but in fact, they're travelling so slowly that you can quite easily cock it up by attacking too fast. And little things like that. But it really, one squadron, what was great was the sheer variety and scope there was for a tremendous number of standard exercises, and mixing up the amount of operational flying. Because often, as I think I mentioned before, it's very true in flying that if you learn lots of tricks, it helps improve your flying. And the FGA-9 was really splendid in that sense of how much you could do on one particular sortie. You could mix up four or five major elements into the one demanding sortie, which was was really great. I think that's about all, really. We had Unison IC, we had Operational SNEB, which I've talked about, we had CFS visits coming in, I had 37, I think, L Adam sorties. I had 16 range sorties elsewhere, 30 live strikes, 5 ground attack at night sorties, 26 TACAR and low-level strikes, 11 low-level Cineweave and low-level combat. But all these are difficult to categorize. 10 FAC, CUFNAVs, lightning affiliations, 6 map trials, tactical reconnaissance, that was also one of our elements. But really all those are slightly incorrect because they were all mixed sorties, and it was almost wrong to pick out one major element in them because we would be doing 2 or 3 other things at the same time. But a really very enjoyable tour, that's really all I'd like to say.
Now, how does it come to an end? So, what's next then?
I didn't mention that I was actually in B flight commander, but really the sort of senior in charge of most of the operational training for the squadron. Andy Whitson had left after, I don't know whether it was, seemed like just under a year, and Mike Webb had joined from the Middle East also. What I didn't mention was there was a slight learning curve, I suppose, after flying in the Middle East, coming back to UK weather, or even though out in Aden you could have some strange weather with this sort of gloom and the sort of monsoon, sometimes a strange weather, sandstorms occasionally there. And out in Aden, I didn't mention that I went in once to Djibouti, which was our local diversion, which was 125 or 135 miles away, which is French Somaliland in those days. But UK and continental weather, particularly in Germany, often in the winter, could be quite demanding in terms of the type of flying we were doing. You're really getting round to my a bit of background on the 50th anniversary. Well,
50th anniversary what?
Of the Royal Air Force.
This is your flight under the Tower of London.
Well, subsequently,
the
yes.
Bridge,
yes.
Tower Bridge.
But
well, explain the background.
Well, I'd been fortunate, I think, to be on 5 of, you know, the well-known fighter squadrons and linked with other squadrons too. And way ahead, I'd say literally weeks ahead, we knew our rough program. Because we had to organise, part of my job really was organising guys' leave and the commitments and which people we would have available when, and the aircraft required for certain commitments, etc., and planning that aspect. Although I must say the boss did a lot of that work, which was good in terms of the more ground side of everything. And I think it was maybe partly because I'd done classics and classic history at school, or ancient history, that maybe I might have had a slightly different degree of interest in military history, and partly, as I said, because of the my job with the EJ as the ADC in Germany, where I'd met all these splendid legendary figures from World War II, and also met so many, or quite a few, that's wrong to say many, but a fair number from my associations from World War I, from the Royal Flying Corps days, and how in many ways how similar they were to us and their way of thinking. And it's interesting that right at this moment, in this sort of year, because I worked it out when I was up at the 90th anniversary, so we're 40 years on now from 43 Squadron, the anniversary reunion that I spoke about. And it's interesting to think that really we're the same age now to the youngsters on that squadron as the Royal Flying Corps guys were to ourselves when we were coming back from Aden. An interesting aspect is that one squadron's history, it's quite surprising in a way that they've still got Harriers, which is great, and gradually developed, but 27 years have gone past from 1969 when they started getting Harriers. That was the following year. And 27 years takes you, going back the other way, before 1969, takes you right back to the beginning of the Furies, the end of the Siskins. And there were 20 years before that, from 1912 to 1932. But it's quite an interesting fact that of the amount of different types in between, after the Fury, the Hurricane, the Typhoon, the Spitfires, and the Meteors, the Harvard short period of Harvard when they were the instrument rating school, and 7 years of Meteor, and the 14 years of Hunter, all wrapped together, is the Harrier period. And that's quite an interesting observation, I think. Well, going back to 1968, all I'm saying that in advance...
This is from the 1st of April.
Yes, yeah, 1st of April. But the lead up to it, I mean, there were one or two, as ever, with almost anything that occurs, so it was a sort of chain of circumstance. And part of it, I must say, was flying, I think it was 75 hours, I think, in 2 months, which is, bearing in mind that you're organising the programme and... The month of February was almost completely spent down at working extremely hard down at Gibraltar, largely to use them for valuable flying hours down there, which one could do. But it was a demanding work, expanding the degree of operational training that one could get out of Gibraltar. It wasn't impossible, but it was quite demanding work. And as I say, there was this strange incident that stuck in my memory forever, I think, about nearly watching my wing commander being killed through the thoughtlessness and the strange, rather bureaucratic or hierarchical treatment that I had, that this person would not
devolve.
Yes, yeah. But I mean, that was an element, I think, in it. Strangely, now, and I'd also had some colds.
In
what subsequently occurred?
Precisely. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, the anniversary of the Royal Air Force was on the 1st of April, which is, as you know, April Fool's Day when it came into being, and it was very much brought into being in the face of an awful lot of opposition. In fact, Trenchard, as you know, was against it all because in the middle of a war. But someone that did see it very clearly was General Smuts, and it was his two reports. And intriguingly, there was a link there because my father had worked for Trenchard after he'd left the Air Force and was looking after the Metropolitan Police. And Smuts, of course, was the commander of the two Imperial divisions down in World War One, when 26 Squadron was the only squadron that was out there, and it literally had 26 different bases in East Africa, German East Africa, and that was a very successful campaign. And it was partly to do with the success he had there that he came back covered in glory, and he worked at cabinet level, as you know, with Lloyd George. And the whole Royal Air Force, the birth of the Royal Air Force came out of that link, and I was proud to have been on 26 Squadron, the Springboks. It was the first Dominion Squadron, and that link with Smuts, of course, and the Smuts reports was vital to the development of the Royal Air Force. And then subsequently, of course, the development in the Middle East and the utilization of air power, because the Air Force nearly got scrambled at birth.
Not really, birth. It's not really a history of okay. aircraft. It's no. what happened. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
they can
okay.
look that up anywhere. I mean, and you weren't there. So,
Now,
so you're preparing for the celebration.
That's right. And we'd asked what was happening and whether we could do something special. And in a way, we were never retasked. We were tasked for forward air control that day after parades. There was a parade in the morning, but there were not, as written now in the Royal Air Force history documents, with few exceptions. One was Cyprus, I think. Some Hunter squadrons down there, and Chivna, after we'd raided Chivna, also put a balbo on that afternoon to sort of celebrate it. But the one thing that was always in the Air Force's blood, really, was that you celebrated in the air, not on the ground, and preferably you did both. And the Abingdon celebration had been was going to be later on in the year, several months later. And we were tasked that week, well, first of all, on the 1st of April itself, we decided that immediately after the parade, I thought it would be a good thing for the airmen's morale, because our airmen had worked extremely hard, and we'd actually ended up beating the other squadron almost in all the three or four major elements that we'd be that were important. And what only later came out, we'd actually been in contention for the honour of being the first Harrier squadron. And by beating 54, which originally was going to be the first Harrier squadron, because one squadron had done so well in that last year and a half, August that year, it was decided that one squadron would be the first to get their Harriers. But going back to the first... immediately after the parade, we'd already prepared some leaflets with Watch the One in the Sun, I think it was, with a cartoonist had done some very good. I've still got a copy of the leaflet somewhere that were done on a Ronio, and also we'd accumulated quite a stock of the what we call the I think we call them 4-inch as opposed to 3-inch, but the 4-inch was the other way round with the bog roll business. And I got airborne, and just with the normal warload in the air brake of the Hunter and the leaflets in the flaps, that's the way we did it. That as the airmen would. You'd get your flaps almost all the way up, and they'd put the leaflets in the flaps. You could obviously have them also in the air brake, but we had the bog rolls in the flaps, and they watched the One in the Sun. And I went off and did a low speed, very low level past the 54 squadron hangar, and we were by far the first off that day. And
Did a
drop at West Raynham on our sister squadron there, 54 squadron. And then, because it sounds a bit Mickey Mouse, but in fact, dropping things at low speed is, again, quite a stretching, interesting exercise, because you could drop things, and we did that in Aden with the 54 squadron, 1417 flight out there, the reconnaissance could drop photographs and things like that to the army in the field. So it sounds a bit Mickey Mouse and silly, but it's not. It was a good training exercise, and we got our four of the guys to go off to different places. We had Walton, Wally Walton went off to do a raid on Wattisham where the Lightnings were. We sent our Peter Albrecht, our American exchange officer, to do a raid on Chivna. And Barry Horton went up to Valley, off very bad weather up at Valley, but I told him exactly how to sort of do it, to do a GCA approach in and then just turn off to one side where the hangars were, and do his drop there. And Colin Becker, we sent off to Coldershaw, rather Ken Becker, who'd actually failed the course at Lightning, and we thought it might be rather good to send him off to Coldershaw where he was, and he did the drop down there. But